Welcome to Already Perfect, the Seattle Soto Zen podcast. And I needed a push to get me to see wherever I
Good morning. How's the sound? Good? I'm afraid this is going to be a short and probably disorganized Dharma talk. I've had a horrible headache for more than a day now, and I'm still feeling pretty gross. My teacher at the abbess at the Chinese monastery that I used to attend in Canada also got really bad migraines, and remember she was talking about the character for patience, which is a knife over the character for knife over the character for heart. It's usually described as a knife suspended over a heart. But she said it's sitting with a knife in your brain, which was how she described her migraines. Though actually you can't take the form of Chinese characters. You can't really take it all that seriously. Some of them make sense, but I remember I asked my Mandarin teacher, how come happiness is a white tree? And she said, it's not. And then she looked at the character, oh, I guess it is. And she just went on like I didn't even ask the question. So they're not pictograms, but sitting with a knife in your brain is kind of how I've been feeling these past couple of days. So I was very sorry to miss the Zazen Kai yesterday, but I just wasn't up for it. I hope that everyone really enjoyed your sitting yesterday. I'm sorry I couldn't be there. Thank you very much, Genzen and Jundo-sama, for running things. So, you know, earlier this week, I listened to some radio show where they were interviewing a young woman who survived growing up in an abusive cult. And it was really heart-wrenching. And actually, what I found most wrenching was when she talked about her first few years after escaping the compound. And she said, you know, even though I'd escaped in body, I was still really committed to the belief system in which I'd been indoctrinated. And of course, that really wasn't good for her, and she developed really bad anxiety, and finally after a few years was courageous enough to go into therapy. And the part that really struck me in this interview was she said at one therapy appointment, her therapist told her, you're enough just as you are, and you are worthy of love. And this young woman, the survivor, completely lost her temper. She responded with a fury that she didn't know she had in her, just screaming at the therapist, that is not true, you take that back. And of course, the therapist thought that was something to work with. And over several months of sessions, kind of worked at unpicking what was so outrageously offensive about you are enough, you are worthy of love. And the cult survivor finally realized, if I believe that's true, if I can accept the truth of what my therapist said, then that means that all of the abuse I survived as a child in the cult was really meaningless. There was no reason for it. You know, if I was really evil and needed the evil beat out of me, then, you know, at least there's some order in the universe, right? And, you know, that just completely broke my heart. You know, this is obviously an extreme story. Most of us didn't grow up in a compound run by an abusive cult. But still, I think there's something relatable in that, those feelings, that response, that even a really painful story is hard to give up, because we're not just giving up our story, we're giving up, you know, a lot more. In this case, the belief in an orderly universe, right? That, you know, if I let go of this resentment I'm holding, then I also have to admit that I've been wasting time by feeling this resentment for so long. There's a psychiatrist named Bruce Perry who works with very severely abused children. And he wrote about how, you know, when you remove a child from the abusive environment, you think everything will be rosy afterwards, right? That's quite often not the case. And it really seems that when the child is placed in a safe environment, they really tend to try hard to recreate the terrible, chaotic dynamics that they're used to in their family of origin. And Bruce Perry said about this, "We prefer the certainty of misery over the misery of uncertainty." You know, if he will just finally hit me already, and then I don't have to keep waiting for him to hit me. We prefer the certainty of misery over the misery of uncertainty. I was talking to a friend of mine a while ago, and they're stuck in this self-destructive pattern. And they knew that they were stuck and that this pattern was self-destructive. And I said, "Well, what about doing something different?" And they said, "But if I do that, I have to give up on the person that I was supposed to be. You know, I also suffer from wasted potential. When I was going into college, there was actually competition between different colleges for where I was going to go. And I got, you know, offered scholarships from more than one place. And, you know, my teachers and guidance counselors and everyone was sure I was going to set the world on fire. And that didn't end up happening. And I think, you know, a lot of us, but probably all of us have felt that way, you know, that there is this, the person that we were supposed to be. We're trying to still be loyal to that and can't let it go. You know, that my dad, after, 30 years, he sold his house at a very small profit. But a few years later, the housing market in that area just went through the roof. So if he held on to the house and rented it out, he would have made a lot of money when he sold it. He still talks about that several times a year. If only I'd held on to that house in Barrie. Right? And we all have that. We all have a house in Barrie, right? A relationship that ended. And we think, what if, you know? Or that we chose the wrong career path. We majored in the wrong subject in college. Or, you know, that day when if we'd left the house 5 minutes earlier or 5 minutes later, we wouldn't have been in the intersection when the accident happened. When my child died, I really would torture myself with these possibilities. You know, kind of like there was I was living another life on a parallel track, you know, somewhere in a, I don't know, an some alternate dimension or something. I was living the life I was supposed to live. And, you know, it is possible that this parallel track even exists, right? There are some interpretations of quantum mechanics that sort of suggested. But even if that's true, the harsh and liberating reality is I can't get there from here. I know I was at a grief support group, and I said, you know, I would give up 10 years of my life for just one more minute with my daughter. And then a little while later, I said, you know, I would. I definitely would, and I would not regret it. And at the same time, kind of relieved I don't actually get to make that choice. Right? That would be so a lot of responsibility that I don't have to worry about, right? There's a book by Jack Kornfield that I really highly recommend. It's called The Wise Heart. And it's about Buddhist psychology. In it, he says, Shunryu Suzuki explains things this way. When you realize the fact that everything changes and find your composure in it, there you find yourself in nirvana. When you realize the fact that everything changes and find your composure in it, there you find yourself in nirvana. In Buddhist Asia, popular culture mischaracterizes nirvana, imagining it as a heavenly realm where old monks go after many lifetimes' work of purity and self-denial. This is wrong. Nirvana, says the Buddha, is immediate, visible here and now, inviting, attractive, and comprehensible to the wise heart. Ajahn Buddhadasa, a colleague of Ajahn Chah, made a point of directing his students to look for nirvana in the simplest ways, in everyday moment. Nirvana, he would say, is the coolness of letting go, the inherent delight of experience when there is no grasping or resistance to life. It is always available. Anyone can see that if grasping and aversion were with us day and night without ceasing, who could ever stand them? Under these conditions, living beings would either die or become insane. We survive because there are natural periods of coolness, of wholeness and ease. It is this which sustains us. We have periods of rest making us refreshed and well. Why don't we feel thankful for this everyday nirvana? We know how to do this. We love to let go of the world at night when we go to sleep. Letting go and having a good night's sleep is delicious. Letting go while we are awake is delicious too. Letting go of clinging to the changing conditions of life, we free ourselves. Ajahn Chah says, let go and rest in the unconditioned, in pure awareness, the one who knows. When we rest in the one who knows, time drops away, self drops away, and the one who suffers is released. We are simply the awareness of it all. Letting go is both the goal and the path. Grace and generosity grow as we let go of the struggles of life. As we let go and still see others suffer, our heart fills with compassion. So much suffering is human-caused. We awaken to a poignancy and tenderness beyond our personal injuries. Our heart is open and we feel connected to all things. Resting in the peaceful heart, we weep at the folly of so many who live in the suffering of greed, hatred, and delusion, who have lost their way. The Tao Te Ching explains, because she has let go, she can care for the welfare of all as a mother cares for her child. When we let go of being the one who suffers, we are free to bring blessings wherever we go. Simple, but not easy, right? I think part of it is, you know, like that story that I told at the beginning, the woman who couldn't stand the thought that you know, if I'm not bad, then there was no need for me to suffer. There was no need for me to be punished. There's this feeling that either we deserve to continue suffering, or we don't deserve to release ourselves from suffering. Or the person who hurt us doesn't deserve for us to release ourselves from suffering. And, you know, it's really hard because, you know, the human mind is really, it's a meaning-making machine, right? We take in all the input from the universe and turn it into stories, which is wonderful. We wouldn't have a human life without it. And at the same time, a lot of stuff in the universe actually doesn't really fit into any narrative. It's just stuff that happens, right? And it's not, you know, that it doesn't happen for a reason. It's just that the reason usually doesn't have anything to do with me. I know Leslie James, who was the abiding teacher at Tassajara while I was there, she said, you know, it's all right for me to see myself as the center of the universe. Because, you know, it's true. In my own universe, I'm the center. Where I run into trouble is when I try to put myself in the center of someone else's universe. Because they're already there. There's no room for me. I know, heard about a therapist who works with people who have trouble with intrusive thoughts. And it's like, you know, I mean, we've all had them when you're, you know, having a really serious meeting with your boss and the thought just flickers through your head. What if I just kissed her on the mouth right now? But unfortunately, these people don't realize that everybody has these thoughts and they really don't mean anything. And they start to obsess over, like, why would I think that? And because they're obsessing over it, it happens more often. And then they really get stuck. So my therapist once said, yeah, sometimes I just tell myself, gosh, I don't think that thought was meant for me. It probably belongs to the guy standing next to me. That was weird. So there's a Pema Chodron wrote about the six kinds of loneliness. And she says, in the middle way, there is no reference point. The mind with no reference point does not resolve itself. To have no reference point would be to change a deep-seated habitual response to the world, wanting to make it work out one way or the other. To have no reference point would be to change a deep-seated habitual response to the world, wanting to make it work out one way or the other. If I can't go left or right, I'll die. When we can't go left or right, we feel like we are in a detox center. We're alone, cold turkey, with all the edginess we've been trying to avoid by going left or right. However, years and years of going to the left or right, yes or no, right or wrong, has never really changed anything. Scrambling for security has never brought anything but momentary joy. It's like changing the position of our legs in meditation. Our legs hurt from sitting cross-legged, so we move them. And we feel, what a relief. But 2.5 minutes later, we want to move them again. We keep moving around, seeking pleasure, seeking comfort, and any satisfaction we get is very short-lived. We hear a lot about the pain of samsara, and we hear about liberation. But we don't hear much about how painful it is to go from being completely stuck to becoming unstuck. The process of becoming unstuck requires tremendous bravery, because basically we are completely changing our way of perceiving reality, like changing our DNA. We are undoing a pattern that is not just our pattern, it is a human pattern. We project onto the world a million possibilities of attaining resolution. We can have whiter teeth, a weed-free lawn, a stress-free life, and a world without embarrassment. We can live happily ever after. This pattern keeps us dissatisfied and causes us a lot of suffering. As human beings, not only do we seek resolution, we also feel that we deserve resolution. However, not only do we not deserve resolution, we suffer from resolution. We don't deserve resolution, we deserve something better than that. We deserve our birthright, which is the middle way, an open state of mind that can relax with paradox and ambiguity. To the degree we've been avoiding uncertainty, we're naturally going to have withdrawal symptoms. Withdrawal from always thinking that there's a problem and that someone, somewhere, needs to fix it. And she talks about 6 types of cool loneliness. She goes on to say that this practice allows us to look honestly and without aggression at our own minds. We can gradually drop our ideas of who we think we ought to be, or who we think other people think we ought to be. We give it up and just look directly with compassion at humor at who we are. Then loneliness is no threat and heartache and not a punishment. When you wake up in the morning and out of nowhere comes the heartache of alienation and loneliness, could you use that as an opportunity? Rather than persecuting yourself or feeling that something terribly wrong is happening, right there in the moment of sadness and longing, could you relax and touch limitless space of the human heart? The next time you get a chance, experiment with this. I think that's important to acknowledge, right? That letting go is painful. And as the Buddha said, apparently when the Buddha first awoke, he was reluctant to teach what he'd realized in his enlightenment experience. And devas encouraged him, and he said, but this teaching goes against the stream, meaning it goes against our habitual patterns of mind. And I think that's really important to acknowledge, you know, that uh, it it sounds so obvious, right? Well, why don't you just give up these stories that cause you so much pain instead of running them through your mind and hurting yourself with them over and over again? Why don't you just stop? And it's because it's not a natural response to stop. We have, remember, Abbot Paul Heller told me, it's very difficult to reason someone out of a position that reason didn't get them into. But we still try, right? We have this wonderful human brain, this miracle of evolution, this meaning-making machine that's constantly running between our ears. And we think it's the answer to all of our problems. Even when it's the problem, we think we can fix the problem with more of the problem, which is why meditation is so difficult. Because it's like somebody said, it's like using the mind to comprehend the mind. It's like trying to cut the handle of a knife with its own blade. I want to read a little bit from one of Genzen's favorite authors, I think, Mingyur Rinpoche, in The Joy of Living. He talks about this. He's Tibetan, a very young Tibetan teacher. He's older now than when he wrote this book and was very young, but and he's very interested in kind of the intersection of Western neurology and Buddhist psychology. So sort of the intersection of the scientific and Buddhist ideas of how the human mind works. He says, at any given moment, you can choose to follow the train of thoughts, emotions, and sensations that reinforce a perception of yourself as vulnerable and limited, or to remember that your true nature is pure, unconditioned, and incapable of being harmed. You can remain in the sleep of ignorance or remember that you are and always have been awake. Either way, you are expressing the unlimited nature of your true being. Ignorance, vulnerability, fear, anger, and desire are expressions of the infinite potential of your Buddha nature. There is nothing inherently wrong or right about making such choices. We choose ignorance because we can. We choose awareness because we can. There is nothing magical about nirvana and nothing bad or wrong about samsara. If you're determined to think of yourself as limited, fearful, vulnerable, or scarred by past experience, know only that you have chosen to do so, and the opportunity to experience yourself differently is always available. In essence, the Buddhist path offers a choice between familiarity and practicality. There is a certain comfort and stability in maintaining familiar patterns of thought and behavior. Stepping outside of that comfort and familiarity involves moving into a realm of unfamiliar experience that may be really scary. You don't know whether to go back to what was familiar but frightening, or to forge ahead toward what might be frightening simply because it's unfamiliar. the certainty of misery or the misery of uncertainty. In a sense, the uncertainty surrounding the choice to recognize your full potential is similar to what several of my students have told me about ending an abusive relationship. There's a certain reluctance or sense of failure associated with letting go of the relationship. The primary difference is that when you enter the path of Buddhist practice, you're ending an abusive relationship with yourself. When you choose to recognize your true potential, you gradually begin to find yourself belittling yourself less frequently. And your sense of confidence and the joy of just being alive increases. At the same time, you begin to recognize that everyone around you has the same potential, whether they know it or not. Instead of dealing with them as threats or adversaries, you find yourself able to recognize and empathize with their fear and unhappiness and spontaneously respond to them in ways that emphasize solutions rather than problems. Ultimately, happiness comes down to choosing between the discomfort of being aware of your mental afflictions or the discomfort of being ruled by them. I can pretty much guarantee that looking at yourself this way will be, at times, extremely unpleasant. But the same can be said about beginning anything new. Whether it's going to the gym, starting a new job, or beginning a diet. And after sharing all those deep thoughts from those Buddhist luminaries, I'm going to share a very silly story really helped me. I was in hospital several years ago, back in Canada, and I just received a diagnosis of a chronic medical condition, which was tough because I was still in my 20s, and I didn't really want to deal with a lifelong chronic illness. So I was in hospital and I was watching TV. And if you're not Canadian, you have not heard of this show, but this show called The Red Green Show came on, which is it's a ridiculous show. It's a Canadian comedian and he plays this character of this handyman, this who is just ridiculous. If the women don't find you handsome, at least they can find you handy. Anyway, so I was lying there in hospital and Red Green shows up on the TV and he said, "I want to talk to you guys who are celebrating your 50th birthday or are just recovering from the hangover. You'll know what I'm talking about when they bring you a birthday cake and tell you that each candle represents a decade. When we reach midlife, most of us review our accomplishments and take stock of our careers, our family situation, and our position in the community. And we often conclude that life stinks and we really blew it. But I say we should look on the bright side. Everybody's life stinks. Nobody gets what they want. Millionaires wish that they were billionaires. Married guys wish they were playboys. And playboys wish they could find someone worth marrying. Maybe you regret not marrying your first sweetheart. Well, don't forget that you're not sweet 16 anymore, and neither is she. If you passed each other on the streets today, you'd both think, boy, some people really let themselves go. So if you're feeling your life is over and you blew it, it's only half only over and you only half blew it. That's what middle age means." Sorry, I really brought the tone of the conversation down a bit. It's true, though, that, and that's the beautiful and difficult truth of this practice, is that happiness isn't found in, you know, looking back on our lives and realizing we've accomplished everything we set out to accomplish and have reached the potential, the shining potential we had when we were very clever youngsters. It's in, you know, just moment by moment, really experiencing our lives as we're living them. I want to close with a poem by David White. Everything is waiting for you. Your great mistake is to act the drama as if you were alone, as if life were a progressive and cunning crime with no witness to the tiny hidden transgressions. To feel abandoned is to deny the intimacy of your surroundings. Surely even you at times have felt the grand array, the swelling presence in the chorus crowding out your solo voice. You must note the way the soap dish enables you, or the window latch grants you freedom. Alertness is the hidden discipline of familiarity. The stairs are your mentor of things to come. The doors have always been there to frighten you and invite you. And the tiny speaker in the phone is your dream ladder to divinity. Put down the weight of your aloneness and ease into the conversation. The kettle is singing even as it pours you a drink. The cooking pots have left their arrogant aloofness and seen the good in you at last. All the birds and creatures of the world are unutterably themselves. Everything is waiting for you. Put down the weight of your aloneness and ease into the conversation. The kettle is singing even as it pours you a drink. The cooking pots have left their arrogant aloofness and seen the good in you at last. All the birds and creatures of the world are unutterably themselves. Everything is waiting for you. Thank you very much. Please take very good care of yourselves. And I needed a push to get me to see. Wherever I am, I'm already free.
Thank you for listening. Please find us at seattlesotozen.org. Our theme music is by Stuart Davis. Gosh, show! Oh.